Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
So it's women, true crime, comedy, what's not to like? Hey guys, my name is Lucy.
I'm Emma. And I'm really nervous about the high expectations you've just set for this whole episode.
And we're going to be recording another podcast about UK true crime.
Yes. I'm starting off, and I'm going to do a well-known case. It involves Lord Lucan.
I've heard the name.
Well, I'd heard of him, and I thought I knew what it was about. And I think growing up, he's just referenced all the time. It's like, oh, they found Lord Lucan. Like, I knew he was missing. And I thought that
I know he's missing.
Oh, did you? I thought that was the crime. I thought that it was like that he'd been kidnapped or he'd disappeared.
So he's a real guy. He's not like, where's Wally?
Oh, no. Yeah, he's a real person. But he went missing, but that's not the main part of it.
Did you know in America, where's Wally is where's Waldo? No one wants to find someone called Waldo.
Is Waldo a name that people have or just Waldo has?
I've never met or heard of a Waldo.
Why don't we just call him Where's Walter? I mean, we're not on personal terms with him. We should be using his formal title.
Yeah, I'm
looking for a man I've never met. I'm not gonna like calling him by his nickname.
Do you remember we went on that night out and we were all dressed as Where's Wally? We just ran off and hid in a crowd every now and then.
Find me.
I remember when I went on chat roulette on my own, dressed as Wally.
On the same day, or you dressed up again?
I think I just put the glasses on the hat on. I was like, this will be hilarious because people are like, we found him, and everyone just went, she looks like a dick, or it was a penis.
It was always a penis.
It's always a penis.
So, Lord Richard John Bingham would be the 7th Earl of Lucan, but more commonly known as Lord Lucan. He was born in 1934 into an aristocratic family, and they'd held the earldom for over 300 years. But like many children who were born into a high society family, he was raised by a nanny and like probably just brought out to see his parents like for an hour a day before bed for a little chat, and then off you go.
That's best way to be, I think. That's perfect.
So he wasn't close to them at all. He did go to a prep school in England, and then when the Second World War broke out, he was sent to America when he was age 6. So he'd been evacuated with his brother and his 2 sisters, and he went to live with the widow of a millionaire banker who had a home in New York, a home in Florida. So she was new money, so she actually had money. I think the aristocracy, even at this time, was in decline, and land rich, not so much. They didn't still have the exact same lavish lifestyle as they would have done. When he came back, he was really sort of disillusioned with the fact that the English aristocracy was nowhere near as glamorous as the lifestyle that he'd had in America. Which is kind of a bit like, because I watch a lot of Teen Mom.
Obviously.
Teen Mom UK is not, it doesn't seem as glamorous as Teen Mom, the American one.
I'm in a Love Island rabbit hole at the moment.
Are you watching the old series?
Yeah, because they've just been added to Netflix, haven't they?
So Richard Bingham, he came back to England when he was aged 11, and he did find this change difficult. He started acting out. He was difficult to manage. And he was eventually diagnosed by a psychologist having an attachment disorder. I assume you
can... I know a little bit about attachment disorders.
Know a bit more about this.
So there's... So Mary Ainsworth is a leading psychologist, and she said that there were four types of attachment. So you've got secure attachment, then you've got insecure, resistant, and insecure avoidant. So insecure resistant would be a baby. So you'd maybe test them about age two, and this is what you'd see. And you'd have a kid that would maybe be, if they're left away from the mother, they would cry and cry and cry and be absolutely inconsolable. But then when the mother comes back, they don't respond to the mother as well. They're still like almost traumatized. So like really clingy baby, but one that hasn't got sort of a confidence to explore the world. And then you've got insecure avoidant, which doesn't give a shit if the parents are there or not, because there's not really a relationship there. So they'll play with a stranger as much as they would maybe a parent. But then you also have disinhibited attachment, which is a bit like avoidant, I think, but I think it's worse.
Yeah.
Like they're more sort of chaotic, and maybe like a kid who's been in care and is really struggling to form attachments.
So, yeah.
So I guess that would be that he's just not really formed a strong attachment. And so other researchers have said that if you don't do that in childhood, then you're going to really struggle with relationships later on. So you might not really trust people and things like that.
Which is basically what we know of him, even when he was... very early as a baby, wasn't forming a strong bond with his parents. And then...
Well, how could he if he never saw him?
Exactly. And then even with his home that he knew in England, he was sent away as a young child. So he didn't have strong bonds with any of his family, really, other than his siblings. And exactly like you said, it's thought that this would lead to his sort of inability to really form loving and trusting relationships as an adult. He just sort of had relationships with people that he needed or that he would find useful and never really connected with them. So it was recommended by the psychologist while he was still young that maybe having a dog would help him sort of get an affectionate bond with another living thing. They use dogs for bloody everything.
I know. My mum was saying how brilliant dogs were last night. She's like, they're just so amazing.
Like dementia, get a dog.
Blind, get a dog.
Can't read very well, read to a dog.
Get epilepsy, get a dog.
Do you think you've got cancer? Let a dog sniff it out. Or is it cats that can sniff cancer?
It's dogs.
Like, they do everything.
They do everything.
I think it might be a dog conspiracy. They're getting on to us. What can we cure next? So I don't believe it worked quite well. And there are some people that believe that he was showing signs of psychopathy as a young child. So he attended Eton College when he came back, which, if you're not familiar, is like a boarding school for the ultimate poshos.
Yeah.
Like the princes went there.
The ones who talk like they've got something large in their mouth.
Like you can't get fancier than that. Yeah. And then I started looking into it about, because I was like, I'm sure Prince Harry and William went there. I've got to go and check. And they did. And then I was reading a thing about how there was an art teacher who won a case for unfair dismissal. And then basically she'd recorded a conversation between Prince Harry, her, and another member of staff discussing how she should complete some of his AS level art coursework so that he could pass. So I don't know how quite it happened, but in the end...
Who gives a shit if he gets art A level or not? Like... The Prince of England.
So she won the case for unfair dismissal, but Prince Harry was also cleared of any cheating. So
no one did anything wrong.
If she was dismissed unfairly because they did ask her to cheat on his coursework, and then he was cleared of, you didn't cheat on your coursework.
Yeah,
it didn't work. He fucking cheated on his coursework. Also, just fail art.
Yeah, I failed it. Who gives a shit? I did. Thank God I did 4 A levels because I got a U in that one.
A U?
I got a U. How can you get a U if you've actually done the work?
Oh, Lucy. You're quite good at like arty stuff as well. We've been life drawing.
I use chicken wire to shape a flapper hanging from the ceiling.
What's
I'm
a
sorry.
Flapper?
So you like, and I put like ties.
Oh, like a flapper dancer.
Yeah, like a dancer from the 1920s. Hello.
Do you have pictures of it?
No, it was fucking terrible. But I did do other stuff, like some paintings and shit.
That was my worst A-level as well. I got a C.
It's because the teacher hated me.
I was so disappointed.
The teacher pure hated me. And then didn't two of the teachers leave to run a cafe together anyway? Because they hated teaching.
So, I mean, Prince Harry could be just as successful as you are now.
Yeah.
With his you. So that's the school that Richard Bingham went to as well. He wasn't one for following the rules, and he was often in trouble. He would skive off, like, go off grounds, gambling massively. I'm imagining sort of, like, riot club style, like, formal wear, cards, casino, that sort of gambling.
Yeah.
So in his last year of school, he was actually threatened with expulsion if he didn't get his act together and stop gambling late into the night. It was getting ridiculous. But he, at this time, he very firmly believed that you could buy happiness. He just felt that there's nothing more to life than being rich and being fabulous. And that if you're not rich and fabulous, it's sort of your own fault. Like, he just had a completely distorted view of the world. And he was definitely cementing his reputation as being a playboy and a womanizer. So, age 19, he was called to enlist for national service. So you'd all have to do 2 years in the army. But because he was a posh, like, they don't do it. It's not a level playing field.
So, not on the front line.
He was sent straight away to the Coldstream Guards, which are, like, super fancy ones. They get to wear the furry hats, and they do a lot of ceremonial and public duties.
Yeah.
Including sort of being the guards at various royal households. So he was still able to maintain his privileged life, and he was known as the biggest card player in the regiment. They'd all just be posh boys together they're probably his entire school year just ended up going to a similar place, and it just continued from there. But he did know that if he was going to maintain his lifestyle at this pace, again, it's old money, not a lot of cash injection, he's going to need to keep company of rich friends. He needed to stay in that circle so that if he did have a big loss, one of his friends could bail him out, because they're all just playing with daddy's money. So one such friend was William Shand Kidd. You don't hear a lot of them about, do you?
Shand Kidd.
Yeah.
Imagine being that rich that you just while away the days spending money. I think I'd be depressed.
I suppose it depends what you want from life, because, like, maybe we'd be depressed because we're looking for connection, we want to see your friends, we want to do things, where he doesn't want any of that. He doesn't have those attachments to people. He just wants to be doing, like, adrenaline-filled, fun things.
Yeah, but I guess it just becomes about showing off and how much people look at you or not, and then I think that's... It's like Love Island. Like, all they give a shit about is what people think of them.
Is this going to be a recurring theme?
Yeah, it's going to come back
to
Love Island.
It's a bit like Love Island.
I'd love to go into Love Island, just be the one that goes, you're a dick, you're a dick. And it's just like, the one with the personality.
I'm going to have to keep in the Love Island references, because they're coming thick and fast. So if anyone's not aware, single guys, single girls go into a house and they lock them in until they have sex with each other.
They basically manipulate them so that they're forced... It is awful. So that they're forced to, if they're not in a romantic relationship, just make it look like they're in one.
Yeah, you have
otherwise
to couple
they
up
get the
and
chop.
Sleep in a bed with someone. Like, you're forced to be in a couple.
It's horrific,
time.
Isn't it, really, when you think about it?
And if someone doesn't fancy you, you're going. So it's really tough. Yeah. But so this friend that he had in particular is William Canchid. Shand Kidd. I love it when that happens. You can't force that.
Spoonerism.
Yeah. But his friend, Bill Shand Kidd, he obviously was a very big posh. His half-brother was Lady Diana's stepfather.
Oh, God.
So 3 degrees of separation, I think, when you get to posh people.
Yeah.
So after his national service was over, he did have to go and get a job. He went and got a job at a bank, but... He eventually just was like, I can earn more money from gambling. And so just sucked it off. He did have some good fortune. He began to get this nickname of Lucky Lucan. I mean, basically, he was either winning, or if he wasn't winning, he'd be getting a friend to bail him out anyway. So
yeah, win-win.
He would appear lucky. He did win at one point. He had a huge win of £20,000 at once in a 2-day long game. It was about £200,000 now. So this was really the thing that spurred him to quit his job and just devote himself to this bachelor lifestyle. He's like, I can earn a couple of years' wages in a night. Why bother? So by the early 1960s, Bingham was spending the majority of his time in a casino where he'd amassed this group of followers who were known as the Lucan Set. it was very Casino Royale, right? Like, imagine that James Bond thing. He had, like, he was tall, he was dark. He looked sort of like Cary Grant. Like, he had the moustache. He was attractive.
Yeah.
So he was really, he was quite well known even before the scandals came out. He was
a thing is, if you've got money, you've just got to almost have a normal face and you'll do fine with a certain type of person that are seeking that out anyway.
All you have to do is watch any series of The Real Housewives and you see a whole group of women who are paying a lot of money to keep themselves super attractive, all the surgery, all the trainers, all the clothes, and then when you meet their husband, they're just the dumpiest lawyer.
Brilliant.
So there was a girl called Veronica Duncan. And she'd moved to London to make her life for herself following her childhood in South Africa in sort of like the colonial areas. And she moved in with her sister. And the two girls, obviously they were young, they were from a nice family. They were soon noticed by Lucan Set. So Veronica's sister, Christina, she married Bingham's bestie, William Shandkid, in 1963. And then just 10 months later, Lord Bingham married Veronica. Now, Veronica was said to have like a nervous disposition. She was quite meek. She would be very submissive to Bingham, who she seemed to be in awe of at the beginning of their relationship. And it's thought that that's probably what drew him to her. He's like, my best friend's married. There's a sister. She's not going to put up any fuss when I'm out gambling all night. I'll just get one squared away.
Yeah.
Basically. So he could, he knew that with her, I mean, I'm not saying that he never loved her ever, but he knew that with her personality, he could continue his lifestyle unchallenged.
Like he could gamble, he could even cheat. Like it's not, it's not gonna be a big deal.
So I think as well, because although she was still from a nice family, she wasn't quite the aristocracy that he was. So it was sort of like there was that imbalance of power in that she's going to want to stay here with me no matter what, because I'm her gateway to this world. So on the 21st of January 1964, the 6th Earl of Lucan, John Bingham's dad, died. So this meant that he inherited a large amount of money as well as the official title of Earl. So then, obviously, he's like, right, now I'm the Earl. It's really pressing that he gets on with getting an heir created. And so the, him and Veronica had three children together. So this was really the turning point for Veronica. She was very protective of her children. Now she had a family, her priorities changed, and she was really now interested in protecting the family as a whole. So she was getting more interested in where's our money going, because we've got a family to support. Where are you at, because you should be here with your children. And she wasn't as happy staying at home as she had been before. So she would even start coming out to the casino to keep an eye on him. And they had like a thing called a widow's bench where all the
like
wives...
The wags.
Yeah, they just have to sit and watch them.
Oh, God. It's a fun night out, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the widow's bench. Widow's bench!
So Veronica, it seemed, as the more he got to know her, it was revealed that she was quite a complex character as well. She had her own diagnosis. She'd been diagnosed with bipolar. And she was taking medication for anxiety and depression. They just began to argue incessantly. And Veronica, in interviews later, said that her husband began a sustained campaign of undermining her and just trying to basically gaslight her, trying to make her look mad. He even tried to get her sectioned at one point. And it was after this failed attempt to get her sectioned that he just packed his stuff and left.
What? Yeah. What, so you left her with the kids?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's mainly that he just couldn't be bothered with her anymore. Not so much that she actually was having a serious breakdown or any of her mental health, but he just didn't want to be involved with this.
Well, I guess in his viewpoint, he's like, I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah.
I signed up for a passive wife who won't bother me.
Exactly. So 1973, the marriage was over and Lord Lucan moved out of the family home and into a nearby apartment. When we say apartment, it was like 5-bed, like still Belgravia, like yeah. Fancy thing. So the split was definitely not amicable, and a vicious custody battle ensued for their 3 children, Francis, George and Camilla. So I was even at, well, then now it's always kind of a bit skewed towards the mother.
Mm.
But obviously Lord Lucan now had the money to fight it. So it went on for a really long time. The lawyers were really intense. But again, this fighting for her family and like fighting against him was brought out that side of Veronica.
Yeah.
And it spurred her to actually push back against him even more. Which in turn, like we're saying, then Lord Lucan just started to harbour more hate for her. Mm. He was like, this is, like you said, this is not what I signed up for. My game plan, sort of, was to have this quiet little life.
Thing is, a lot they can throw at each other as well, isn't there? Because if he's out all the time gambling, then you can use that against him. But then if she's got bipolar, then he can start throwing that in her face.
Exactly that. And during the hearing, Veronica then spilled the beans on some of Lord Lucan's sexual preferences.
Oh.
And because he's a society figure, that becomes news.
Yeah.
So at the time...
I know, I want to get in on this gossip now.
I know.
What was it?
Well, at the time, these were seen as really perverse and scandalous.
Oh, God.
It's...
69.
I was going to say, it's not as exciting. Well, I did hear one thing that said he'd have her exercise in rubber clothing before bed.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, it's not, I don't know, I thought just exercise in rubber clothing.
I guess like a sexy catsuit.
Yeah, I think that. And then he had a cane that he would spank her on the bottom with before they had sex. And you hear her talking about it and she's like, well, he could have hit me hard, but he must have liked it because he had sex with me afterwards. And like, she literally can't comprehend the fact that someone would be turned on by that. It's really interesting the way she's like, well, he must have enjoyed hurting me because he did have sex with me. Of course he enjoyed spanking you.
Yeah.
But I guess now we just take that as a thing.
Yeah.
Like, but at the time, they're like, oh my God, he's absolutely disgusting. So this hearing, the custody hearing lasted for days. Eventually custody was given to Veronica. And the whole thing cost around £40,000, which even in the 70s was a huge amount of money. And of course, Lord Lucan had to pay for his legal fees. And because he's technically still supporting Veronica, he was paying for her side as well. So it made not much sense yeah, to be doing it.
Fighting himself.
The court did stipulate, however, that if Veronica was going to have full custody of the children, she had to employ a nanny to help her out. Which, fair enough, but I doubt the loss of Lord Lucan was really
yeah.
much of a, you know, hardship. But so she had to hire a nanny. So September in 1974, a girl named Sandra Ribbett was hired. She was a hairdresser.
What?
Before.
So she wasn't a nanny.
She hadn't been much of a nanny. She had looked after, I think she'd started to look after children in the local area.
There's no like actual nannies around. Like, just, she could cut their hair as well, it'll do.
That's a bonus, isn't it? I think she was just a normal girl, basically. She wasn't from that world. She was a working class
yeah.
girl. She, like I say, she'd done normal jobs and then wanted to get into childcare. So she was hired. And she was described as being lively, bright, really well-liked. But it would only be 2 months into her employment, on the 7th of November 1974, that things would take a devastating turn.
Oh, God. So does he... I'm going to guess that he tries to crack on with her, and she says no, and then he murders her.
Final answer?
Final answer.
They go to Love Island and they all sleep in a big bed. I don't know. So basically, Lady Lucan has a very strict routine. She, every night at 9 p.m, she goes down, because it's like a many-storied townhouse, so the kitchen's in the basement, I guess, but
yeah.
A nice basement. She goes down into the basement kitchen, makes herself a cup of tea before bed, every single night on the dot. I can get on board with that.
Yeah, that's... my life.
This particular night on the 7th of November, it would normally have been Sandra's night off, but for some reason or another, she'd switched her days. So she'd offered to go down and make the cup of tea instead.
Shouldn't mess with the system.
So she would be carrying crockery. She would be, have had to have gone down into the basement kitchen. And when she got there, she wouldn't have been able to turn on the light because the bulb had been taken out of the big light. So complete darkness. And then as she's fumbling there, it's believed that she was approached from behind and bludgeoned in the head with a length of metal pipe, which killed her.
Sure. I thought it was going to be more a fairy than that.
Nope.
Oh, sure.
Her body was then...
So they thought she was Veronica.
Possibly. I mean, there's no witnesses to this side of it, so...
Yeah, they must have done.
Her body was then put inside a big US mail sack, supposedly so that it could be carried out and disposed of. So, at this point, Lady Veronica hears some noise, like, where on earth is the maid with my tea, and had gone down into the basement herself, where, as she was heading down, she too was met by this figure. And she was violently hit in the head 4 times with the metal pipe. She received blows to the front of her head, was bleeding really profusely, but didn't die. Lady Lucan then recalls recognising this attacker as being her husband.
Fuck.
So, from here on out, the events that we know are Lady Veronica's story. So, her story goes that she recognised him, he tried to strangle her, and she just basically managed to fight him off as much as she could. She fought back with everything.
Yeah.
Eventually, after some time of fighting, she was asking, like, where's Sandra? And he just went, she's dead. Don't look at her. And I think she believes that bringing up Sandra sort of snapped him into reality. Because that, she thought it would obviously hadn't been his plan. She thought he must have been here to kill her.
Yeah.
And then in the darkness, got Sandra instead. So she kept talking about it. She thought, now that he's faced with what he's done, his plan's gone to pot, it sort of stopped him in his tracks a little bit. So she then described how she tried to placate him by talking about how, you know, it's going to be fine. Nobody's seen anything. We can deal with this. It'll be okay. And just trying everything she could to stop him from killing her then. She then said that she was like, I want to wash the blood off. So he said that he took her up to her bedroom and put her on the bed and said, take these sleeping pills, basically, to try, she thought, possibly to kill her that way.
Yeah.
He then went into the bathroom ensuite and began running the water, presumably so he could clean up the blood. So Veronica obviously knew that he wouldn't be able to hear as well with the running water. So she took her chance then and crept out of the room and just ran out of the house to the nearest pub.
Yeah.
Which we'd all do. Need a fucking drink after that.
Yeah. And so the kid's still in the house.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Well, she says that she'd gone into the... In one interview, she said that she'd gone into the bedroom and her daughter, Frances, had been in her mum's room watching TV.
Yeah.
And so Lord Lucan had just gone, oh, go to your room. And so she got up and left. But I don't know, because then my dad doesn't live here. You'd be like, oh, hi, daddy. Oh, mum's with you. Why is she bleeding? A lot of that. But then Veronica did change her story a little bit over the years. But she'd been hit in the head a lot of times.
True.
So she ran into this pub, it was called the Plumber's Arms. And apparently, a couple stories say that when she first ran in, she was just screaming that he's tried to strangle me. But the head barman at the time remembers her running in and saying that. He said, well, she was obviously delirious because you could see that she'd been smacked in the head and was bleeding everywhere. Yeah. So she was obviously incredibly confused at the time. So some of the details may have been fuzzy.
Exciting times at the local, though, wouldn't it?
I know, right?
It's going to cause a stir. Particularly when it's like the poshos down the road. Everyone would be lovely that.
Exactly. So the police were called, and one of the first officers on the scene was Don Baker. And he saw an interview with him, and I'm not sure what his angle is. I feel like he definitely believes Veronica's lying or hiding something.
Right.
I don't know what her motive would be for that. Because no one's gaining any money, no one's gaining anything from setting up this story.
Yeah, why would she... I mean, it's not like she'd be in on the murder prior, because why would she want her own maid to be killed?
No idea. But he doesn't say that explicitly. Basically, he said, I arrived at the pub and there was Lady Lucan ranting and raving. Well, she's been fucking smacked to the head. Harsh.
Ranting and bloody women.
He then said that she'd said, oh, my husband's done this to me, and went to take them to her home. And then he goes, oh, and she just turns around really casually and went, oh, and he's killed the maid as well. I was like, I really doubt she said it like that. But... well, do you know what I mean?
She's pretty posh as well.
You're in an absolutely massive... If you're bleeding massively from your head, you've been... whatever's happened, she's sustained a really serious injury. And he's like, well, she said it in a really weird way. Well, you probably... Things do just... She hadn't
Maybe
seen
she
the
just
body.
Did.
Well, I don't really know. But this police officer wasn't impressed with her. That's all I know. So the police arrived at the Belgravia home and they found in the kitchen doorway the blood-covered mailbag. And then when they sort of moved it, an arm came out and they knew that must have been Sandra Rivett. So there's no DNA at the time, but they were using blood type analysis. And so Veronica was blood type A, which matched the blood samples that were at the top of the stairs, which fit with her story of that being the attack site for her. And then Sandra was type B, and that matched the samples found in the kitchen from the first attack site. So it did all seem to support Lady Lucan's story of the two women both being attacked at separate times in that way. So an arrest warrant was immediately put out for Lord Lucan. He had borrowed a friend's car a week previously, which shows that he'd probably planned this for a while, and he'd fled in that down to Uckfield in Sussex. He drove to the home of a friend called Ian Maxwell Scott, who wasn't home, but his wife let him in, and she listened to his story. And he told her that he'd returned home and found his... he'd returned home and found this sort of scene of the attack. Another man was attacking these women. Yeah. And then... but had obviously gone.
So he ran off.
Well, yeah, he thought, well, I'm obviously going to be in the frame for this. He was telling her that there was a conspiracy to frame him, basically. No. So they've been attacked. Everyone's going to think it's me, so I've got to run away. But this was met by some derision from people that heard it. Because not only is it unlikely, it really closely resembled the storyline of a TV show at the time, The Fugitive, that was really popular. It'd been on TV for a long time.
Yeah, I've seen a film of The Fugitive, but yeah, didn't they do a series as well?
Yeah, so I think people are like, oh, he's obviously just got his inspiration. So he did stay at that house just for a couple of hours while he wrote out two letters, both of them to William Shandkid. One of them was basically stating his innocence, saying, I've not done it, but I've got to leave. And the other one was more of a business letter saying which of his possessions he should sell at Christie's in order to pay off his gambling debts, which were in like the 40,000s at this point. He also phoned his mother. He'd phoned her twice. He phoned her once, sort of like in a rambling, clearly shocked state, just saying, will you go and get the children? He then phoned her after he'd written his letters. She had the children and was with a police officer. And he said, well, do you want to speak to him and tell him what your story is? He was like, no, I'll talk to them in the morning. It's fine. And just hung up.
Tired now.
So about 1:15 a.m., so still only a matter of hours after Sandra's murder, Lord Lucan left the Maxwell Scott house and he drove off. And this was the last time that he would be officially seen by anyone. 3 days after the attack, police found the car that Lucan had borrowed abandoned in New Haven in Sussex. Type A and B blood were both found in the car, along with some fibres from the house. There was some notepaper matching a note that Lucan had written to one of his friends, and there was also some lead piping in the boot, which matched, it wasn't the exact one, but it matched the one that was found in Belgravia. So he had just been able to disappear off the face of the earth. He was never found, seen, anything. Just the car was found.
That's what money does, isn't it?
And so this story has then sparked conspiracy theories that have gone on for decades.
Wow.
Some people say that he's still alive now. I mean, he'd be young. He'd be the same age as my granddad.
Yeah.
So he could... So a lot of people say that he could still be around, and some people say that other things. So I'll tell you a couple of the... stories. So one theory is that which is the one that I think is probably the most likely, is that he'd driven that car to New Haven and then, because he knew there was no way out, had drowned himself in the harbour, because New Haven's like a port area, drowned himself in the harbour where the car was found. It seems the most plausible.
But they never found a body.
But if you put like rocks and stuff in your pockets and go to the bottom, I don't know that they dredged it or anything. But that's what I think is likely. So that's one option. Another one is that there was a woman called Shirley Roby, and she worked for a friend of Lord Lucan's, John Aspinall. And she came out later saying that she'd overheard conversations in the like 70s, 80s between John Aspinall and other people about Lord Lucan's hiding. Mm. So she said he was hiding somewhere in Africa, basically. Just he's hiding somewhere. In somewhere 100 times the size of England, isn't it? Great. But then she got a lot of criticism for saying that, well, if you'd heard people talking about him hiding, why didn't you inform anyone? She said, well, I didn't know he'd committed a murder. But I found that really, like I said at the beginning, I didn't know he committed a murder. But she's talking about in the actual 70s when it happened.
Yeah.
Surely if anyone's mentioning his name, you'd know what the story was. So I'm not so sure about that one. And they might have been discussing his possible hiding. It doesn't mean they hid him.
Yeah.
So that was one. Another one, a guy called Philippe Marc. He was a friend and he claims that to have been told by another friend that...
Does anyone know him?
That Lucan... Basically, I think if you hung around the casino, you could claim you were his friend and get 15 minutes in the paper. But he said basically that Lucan went to his mates and said, what on earth am I going to do? He wanted to kill himself. And they said to him, right, kill yourself, fine. But the only reason you've done all of this is to get Veronica away from your children. So if you're going to kill yourself, we need to make sure your body is never found, because if you can't be proved to be dead, then your title can't be passed on to anyone and your estate can't be passed on to anyone, so Veronica still won't have any hold over the children and their finances. Gosh. Basically, so they said, so this John Aspinall, again, this crazy friend, it said that he had a private zoo. And Lucan shot himself and then they fed his body to the tigers in John Aspinall's zoo, which is why he's never been found.
That's fucking badass, though.
The police actually did investigate this, the tiger story. Well, and he was like, as if I'd feed Lucan to my tigers, they only have the priciest cuts or something.
That's grim.
So, yeah. Then there are even members of Bingham's family that maintain his innocence and say he didn't kill anyone and he just left the country and he's living abroad. They don't know it, they're just hoping that that's the theory.
But you'd want to believe your family was innocent.
Yeah. But it's really interesting, like, this discussion about why so many... Like, so I watched a documentary, Fred Dinage, classic, about this case. And he was having a discussion where they went and interviewed people on the street and basically said to them, what do you think happened to him? What do you think happened to him? And so many people believed that he had got away with it and believed in one way or another that he was basically doing a Ronnie Briggs and was like living abroad, plastic surgery, that kind of thing. And they were talking about the psychology of why do people want to believe, it's like they want to believe that he got away with it. And it's sort of like
he killed a fucking innocent girl who'd like had a whole life ahead of her.
And that's the sort of thing with this case, is that the murder's often forgotten because this getaway and this mystery of him going, it overshadows everything. And people sort of like want this fantasy of being able to be a fabulous rich person and just jet off and stick two fingers up to the like police.
Yeah,
I don't know where that comes, but
they're not thinking about the parents of that poor girl.
Yeah.
Because they deserve him to be fucking caught.
Yeah. So even at the time, so then obviously there would have to be an inquest into this death. There was a huge media frenzy around it, but people there at the time described it as having a jovial atmosphere.
Oh my God.
And again, it's this really lighthearted thing of like, oh, rich man's gone and done this mad thing. And of course, the family of Sandra Rivett were furious about it, that this is, we've got a dead daughter and all anyone cares about is where is this guy, is he having a lovely time or not. But the inquest was held, and this was actually the last time in British law that the coroner's jury were able to give a verdict where they named the murderer. So they did return a verdict that she was killed by blows to the head and that it was John Bingham that had done it. Even though he's never been tried or convicted, he's named on her death certificate as being the cause. Which I suppose could possibly give some closure to Sandra's family in that he's never been caught, but he is officially...
He must have died because he wasn't even... He was in debt, wasn't he? He wasn't even super rich. He did have an estate and things, but he didn't have shitloads of cash, did he?
But well, I suppose people think that he's got these rich friends. He had asked Shan Kidd to sell his stuff. Could he be sending him money?
Yeah.
I'm not one for massive conspiracy theories anyway. I just think he killed himself, but...
Yeah.
It's possible. So it wasn't until 1999 that he was officially declared dead and his family were given probate over his estate. But there was still no death certificate ever issued.
Which, so they couldn't shut down his Facebook account.
Nope. And which meant that his son George Bingham, basically, he if you've got a title in England, then you're automatically given a seat in the House of Lords side of Parliament. So his son, George Bingham, wanted to be able to go to the House of Lords. And when he was declared dead, said, right, I'm ready to take my place. But they said, without the death certificate, no title, no lordship, nothing. This was granted in 2016, I believe. I mean, but he still maintains that his dad was innocent and I bet they're a bit like, I think they put him off as well because they're like, well, we don't really want you around a little bit. But his wife, like I said, Veronica, when I've been talking about her interviews, she spoke in a documentary in 2017 called My Husband, My Truth that you can find, which is quite interesting. But then not long afterwards, she was actually found dead. On the 26th of September 2017, she had been estranged from her children for years, since the 80s. I'm not quite sure why, but they were cut out of her will completely. And she left everything she had to Shelter, the homeless charity. So there's a nice ending for you.
Yeah. Lovely. Amazing.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So, after a brief interlude and a chat about RuPaul's Drag Race,
we're back.
So, I'm going to tell you about Kenneth Erskine, the Stockwell Strangler, which I'm a bit scared still that we might have already done, but...
Either we've done him, or we've just independently read about him. I must just keep thinking, oh, I'll do him one day.
But I couldn't find him in our past episode, so we must be okay. But I got a lot of this information from a book with the same name. It's called Kenneth Erskine, The Stockwell Strangler by Andrew Alexander, which is literally £2. So if you want to, like...
Oh, so you actually bought this one?
Yeah.
Nice.
So, like, if you want to, like, download it and read along.
And then when you hear this ding, turn the page.
Yeah. But go on then, like, give Andrew Alexander a couple of quid. Like, he deserves it for this. So this is the story of Kenneth Erskine, and I hope I'm saying that right. I think it's about right. It's spelled E-R-S-K-I-N-E. Erskine is my best guess. So he was born in 1963 in Hammersmith, and he had a British mother, and his father was from Antigua.
Antigua.
Antigua. It's got a U in it. Thank God you're here. So he grew up in a council flat after his mother and father divorced, and he was one of four sons. And he was described as being quite a calm kid by neighbours who were later interviewed. So once he reached teenage years, his behaviour deteriorated quite rapidly, and he was sent to a special needs school. I think it was picked up that he had quite a low IQ, and he was not very academic. And this carried on. Like, he definitely had some sort of learning disorder or disability.
Right.
And he began to have quite violent outbreaks. So from this calm, placid sort of younger kid, he became really quite violent. He would attack other pupils. He would attack staff. And then he tied up younger students when they went to swimming lessons. And also, like, just push their heads under the water.
Like a foam noodle. Like,
yeah. But, like, push their heads under the water as well. Not till they passed out, but, like, that's quite bad.
Just waterboarding people. Just some casual waterboarding.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why it had taken so long to realise he had learning difficulties, though, because he'd been so quiet as a youngster? You know, if he's not causing them any problems. I'm not saying we as teachers do it, but I know there are teachers where if they've got a kid who's a bit quiet, isn't really kicking off, they're like, oh yeah, I don't really know about him, why he's not getting it.
Yeah, it's the ones that kick off that are the ones that you've got to like focus on, aren't they? That's the problem. But possibly, but I think it was picked up youngish. I think he went to a school quite young,
right.
But then it's puberty that sort of set him off on this behaviour, and then it got so bad that he stabbed a teacher.
Whoa.
In the hand with scissors. And then...
Oh, I felt that.
It's horrid, isn't it?
Like, right in slicey. The little tendony bits.
But then, then the teacher obviously called for help, and a nurse came to the school, to, obviously the same day, to try and assess him and examine him. And he got her and he held scissors to her throat, but he's obviously still holding. So
even the shitty safety scissors, we have the little round red ones. They could still fuck someone up if you like really jabbed it in my throat.
Yeah, proper.
I'd never sing again. I'd be like Julie Andrews, though. And then I'd rise to the occasion and there'd be an assembly when I just went to the front, like, time to... And everyone'd be like, she's got it!
Like that one out of Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
Suddenly starts singing and everyone's like, oh, shit. But I guess, like, he's got these scissors to her throat and she's like, yep, he's definitely crazy.
That's my assessment. Official assessment is he's a little bit angry. Let's work on there's a volcano in my tummy.
So he also began to show his genitals to female staff and say sexual things to them. So he's a very confused young man. So at home, he tried to hang his little brother, with a rope twice.
Hanging's a weird thing. Like, how do you know about... Do you know, I just think, like, do you think you invent, you know, if you'd never been exposed to hanging, do you think you invent hanging?
I mean, I'm
sure that he probably did know about hanging.
I don't think I knew about hanging. I'm sure I probably whipped a shoelace around a Barbie and swung around my head a few times. But
oh, yeah.
I'd think of it as a way of murder, probably.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking as a kid. Like, I don't think I'd think to do it.
I think the kids are exposed to so much so young these days. They know suicide, rape. I had said to Year 7 the other day, because we were going to discover if Lady Macbeth was really responsible for the murder of King Duncan through criminal, like, they're going to look at the evidence and stuff. And it was a bit like CSI. And I said, has anyone seen any sort of crime documentaries? And one put their hand up and said, yeah, I watched this one where someone got raped and there was semen all over the bed.
God, year seven. It was like my kids, we had to practice, did I tell you about how we had to practice lockdown?
No.
For, so we were having to practice lockdown procedure for if don't know, various things happen. Someone's on the school grounds and like get all the kids into the corridor and sit down where no one can see you, there's no windows, all that sort of stuff. But I hadn't, obviously I was trying to explain it to the children in a kid appropriate way. So I was like, well, normally if there's a fire or anything, we go onto the playground. But if for whatever reason the playground isn't suitable for it, we need to practice where we can go in the school building. And then one of my kids just went up, like if there's a perv or something. And I was like, yeah. Like if there's a perv.
There's a guy with his knob out outside.
And the other kid's like, what's that? What's that? I was like, shut up.
Moving on.
He's like, he means a dog. He means an angry dog. Now pipe down.
Yeah. Oh God, the things they come out with. So it was, so he tried to hang his brother twice, but it was when his mother found that he'd given his brother cannabis is when she threw him out. That was the line.
Like, that's the straw that tips the cannabis. Stab the teacher as many times as you want, but you will not smoke pot in this house. Yeah.
So he never saw his brothers or his family again after that. Literally ostracised from the whole lot.
Well, so, they'd had enough.
He spent 7 years after that. I mean, he's still very young at this stage. So he spent 7 years basically homeless. Obviously, he's not got a house. He's not going to go to the school. No one's going to make him go to school.
But there's no evidence that there was any issue. I mean, his parents divorced, but there's nothing about his parents mistreating him or...
No. I think it's mental health.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he stayed in squats and he would commit petty crimes to have money to buy food. He tried being a Rastafarian for a while, but the other Rastafarians pretty much didn't want him hanging around with them because he was a criminal lowlife who shows his knob to women. So they thought it's not really our thing. He had a mental age of an 11-year-old at sort of his most advanced. So,
That's like enough to get by, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say. Like, if you're 11, like, you can have conversations with people.
Yeah.
You can sort of get by, but...
It's just very immature, isn't it? Rather than it being...
Intermediate level Sudoku.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking.
Like, you can talk to... You can have a conversation with an 11-year-old, but it's not going to be that engaging.
They're going to get themselves dressed, but they're not going to pay their bills.
Yeah, that's it. So at 18, he had his first gay relationship with another person. I think he was staying, I mean, there wasn't a lot of information, I'm inferring quite a lot, but I think he was sort of staying in maybe a hostel or a squat or something like that. But this ended when he broke into his boyfriend's bedroom and then tried to attack him with a knife. So although the boyfriend didn't press charges, the relationship was pretty much over from that point.
Yeah.
This isn't for me. So alongside criminal behaviour, there were various assaults. He was living as a drifter, but he would also paint. And this was his way of sort of expressing himself, expressing sides of himself that he couldn't verbally express.
But he didn't get a U.
And sharing it with others. Unfortunately, what he wanted to express was pictures of elderly people tied to beds and gagged on fire and with daggers in them.
See, why elderly people, though?
Totally obsessed with the elderly. Yeah, but there's no sort of big involvement with his grandparents. There's no... there's nothing that sort of expects... Maybe it's
there
the fact
must
that,
be a reason, because they're easy targets.
I think the vulnerability, the
because
easy
he's
targets,
scared of being old.
Maybe because he hasn't had contact with older people. There is a bit of research by Harvard that looked at sort of stereotypes about the elderly, and children who spent a lot of time with their grandparents were much less prejudiced against old people because they saw them as just a grandparent or a person, whereas kids who didn't really see their grandparents were like, old people are stupid, old people don't know things, like, just
right.
More like, old people are rubbish.
Yeah.
So I guess he didn't have that social contact maybe with older people, and therefore wasn't really as empathetic towards them. I don't know, but very much that's all his art was.
I just think it's interesting. I mean, if you we don't know for sure, just because it's quite unusual to target the elderly in that sort of like venomous way.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people target elderly people like as in like, oh, I knock on their doors and pretend to be a gas man because it's easy. But to like in your own head be like really hate for specific old people, you'd think there must be something that we don't know about why he did that.
I think it's like nurses who target ill people. It's just easy.
Get a new fucking job.
Yeah. But like there's that... there's a few killer nurses, aren't there? I mean, Harold Shipman was for the money, but there's a few that did it for the thrill of killing, but it was the easiest way to achieve that. It's just they're not going to find
that. Like a god complex, isn't it?
Yeah. And when I go through it, I think you'll see that a little bit. So summer of 1986, this is when he begins his attacks on the elderly. And a lot of the sexual assault, I will say, in the book I read, it was described as sexual assault. But actually, when they talked about it in court, they did say it was always buggery.
That's like I said last week, how rape against men wasn't actually recognised and it was just classed as an assault.
Yeah, and a lot of this is against men. So... yeah, but they did say also they couldn't tell if the buggery happened before or after the killing. So I just don't know.
Just call it rape.
It's just horrid. So the first victim was Nancy Eileen Ems. She was aged 78 and she lived in Wandsworth. And she was found by her carer on April the 9th, 1986. And they assumed at first that she had either fallen or she maybe had a heart attack and she died. And a death certificate was signed as being down to natural causes. But then they realised that her TV was missing. I thought, well, that's a bit weird. So they had another look at the body. So in the post-mortem, they found that she actually had been strangled and her body had bruising on it as well. And the only evidence they could find for someone having done this was a little piece of hair from someone who was had Afro-Caribbean hair. So they just had this singular hair.
Was he black?
So Janet Cockett was age 67 and she lived quite near to Nancy. So it's a very small area that he's targeting in Wandsworth. And she again appeared to have died peacefully because what he would do is he would murder them and then he'd put them back in bed, but he'd sort of curl them up so they looked like they were just asleep. And put the covers back over them.
Maybe thinking he was covering his tracks.
Possibly, or there's some weird thing that he... it's hard to get into the mind of a killer, isn't it? It's just horrific. So in post-mortem, they saw signs of strangulation and bruising and she had broken ribs. So it was clear that this was a murder. And also the photos in her room had been put face down or turned around. So it's almost like he didn't want them watching.
While he was having sex with her.
What a weird... Why bother? If you're doing something so perverse... I don't understand why you'd give a shit about the pictures.
He's obviously got his own moral code, hasn't he? It's not completely... It's not... That's what maybe suggests mental health for me. Obviously, I don't really know anything. But for me, I would read that as it's not like he knows what's right and what's wrong and he's doing what's wrong. It's that he thinks that it's... He's got his own sense of right and wrong.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks that, oh, this isn't appropriate for them to be looking.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing is what I should be doing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been watching too much of The Alienist. They're just like, this must mean this.
I need to watch that. I'll get off Love Island and get on The Alienist. So this time, though, they did find a partial print, but it was a print of his palm, and which I've never really heard about palm prints being much of a thing.
The Bible. I was explaining to... Tom, that we went to visit a church when we were in Brussels, and I was explaining about how his name is from, like, Doubting Thomas. I was like, "Do you even know that story?" He's like, "No." So then I was like telling him a Bible story while we were in a church, and these tourists started gathering round. I was like,
"Thinking you were like this."
Yeah, I was like, "That's it for today. Bye."
Money in the hat, please. That's hilarious.
It's a free tour, but if you just want to donate whatever you feel, it's right.
Sign into Patreon. It's patreon.com/thoughtofthepodcast. So they found. The thing that I find weird about the fact that he's... Because there's another palm print.
I'm going to say, did they do it on, like, oh, his lifeline's very short?
Well, I guess. They use the markings. But...
Murder line is fucking huge.
So the problem was, so he'd been in trouble and been arrested for minor crimes, like this stealing that he was doing before. So they did have fingerprints, but... They were using the database by this time for fingerprints, but for palm prints, they did keep palm prints of criminals, but you had to physically go and look and compare. So you'd have to look, so someone would have to, because it wasn't on a database, it hadn't all been uploaded.
They're just checking against, like, the Hollywood Walk of Fame, like, okay, it's not Reese Witherspoon, nope. Like, where else do you keep palm prints?
I guess that, well, they had a database of, They had a physical database of them, but you'd have to go and sort of look at each one. So they were just focusing on that local area, but still...
Because it couldn't digitally match it.
So still, there was about 3 months' work. I mean, I don't know who's slacking off that much, but it was about 3 months' work. I could have done it in a week, I reckon. Like, 8 hours a day, looking at palm, like, comparing how many
people... Yeah, but you couldn't do it consistently, could you? Like, your brain would just start to slow down.
Maybe. So actually, that is what got him caught later on.
Nice.
But it took so long to match that up. But I also, what is he fucking wearing? Like, little finger gloves, but he gets sweaty palms, so he's got the palm print, like, cut out. Why is there no fingerprints? And yet he's got palm prints. How weird. Is he just smashing his palm against stuff?
Like on The Simpsons, they're like, if your fingers are too fatted out, just mash the keypad with your palm.
Yeah, that's it. So his next victim was... this person was a potential victim. So Frederick Prentice, he was 73. He lived in a retirement home in Clapham, and he was a retired engineer. And he was still awake, and he heard the sound of someone creeping down the corridor and then slowly opening his room. So this is like a retirement home. So this is a
gold mine.
An institution. So it's not like a guy living on his own. He's
there's people everywhere.
Yeah.
Unless it's a retirement community and he's in his own little
There's stuff
flat.
Stuff around the hood.
So that's fucking ballsy.
Yeah. He targets a few.
He obviously thought, I'm fed up of working out where old people live. I'm just going to go where all the old people live.
Yeah. So Frederick shouted, "Get out," to him. But Erskine grabbed his neck and he began to choke him. And Frederick survived this, and he says that what he did was he would choke him and then stop and let him breathe. And then he'd choke him, almost like he was toying with him and sort of playing with the idea of, I could kill you any moment. So then he dragged Frederick out of bed and he pushed him against the wall, where he was knocked unconscious. And it's thought that he just thought that he'd killed him then. So he just left. So Frederick was found by staff. And he gave a description to the police of what he'd seen and heard. But he also said, this is the creepiest bit, during the attack, Escreen had just been whispering, kill, 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 just the whole time. How fucking freaky is that?
Maybe he had voices.
Oh, horrid. So another retirement home, this time in Stockwell. Erskine broke in just one night. This is the night after he'd attempted to kill Frederick. So he is just binging. So he targeted two men in his retirement home in adjoining rooms. There was Valentine Gleam, 84, and Zbigniew Strabała, 94. Both Polish. Sorry, I've fucked up those pronunciations, but... So he sexually assaulted and strangled both of the men. And stole items from their rooms. So at this point, police realised they were after a serial killer. Mm. After four killings and one attempt. So the next victim was William Carman. He was aged 84. And he still lived in his own flat. And Erskine broke in. And he assaulted him and strangled him before stealing around £500 of his savings. Then he targeted William Downes, aged 74. So, mostly older, like, quite seriously old. I don't know.
Like, frail.
Like old and frail. Not like, shame when you say, oh, they're a bit old, but you really
mean
just
elderly.
About, like, yeah. So, old and frail. So, he was living in a bedsit. He was sexually assaulted. He was strangled. And then another palm print was found, and that matched the one that they'd found.
It's just like high-fiving pillows.
Yeah, weird. And that matched the one that they'd found previously. But again, why just the palm?
Not a bloody palm print, because he's strangling. So literally just a sweaty palm print.
Yeah, on objects, not on people. Oh. So...
Clammy. Clammy Davis Jr.
But who's touching things palm first? If he's walking around with his fingers bent back, thinking, I've got to worry about the fingerprints.
Yeah, that might... Do you know what? That literally might be what he's doing. We said he's as clever as an 11-year-old. I can literally picture my kids doing that. Like, no fingerprints, just grabbing things with two palms, like a little...
Maybe. Yeah. So...
Wear gloves.
So Florence Tisdall, aged 80, was the next victim, and she lived in another retirement home in Fulham, and she was sexually assaulted and strangled. She was found by a caretaker on July 23rd, and she was described as being totally helpless. I mean, she was half deaf, she was pretty much blind, like really frail older person, very weak. And she had cats, and she would leave the window open for her cats, so he'd probably got open through an open window. And I think probably that's the case for a lot of these, that it was just, he'd target places that may be a bit easier to get into, because there weren't a lot of signs of breaking an entry, so it would be an open window here, or finding a way in through some place. It's believed that there's probably more victims as well, because he would make it look like they were sleeping peacefully.
Some of them must have thought it was natural causes.
So due to the small area that the killings were happening in, police focused on that area, and they produced a profile of what they thought the suspect was probably like. So they said that he's probably black, young, quite strong, goes out at night quite a lot, possibly working with the elderly, or maybe recently fired from a job at a care home. But it was that palm print that got him arrested. So eventually they were able to match up the palm prints they'd found with the ones that had been taken at the time of his arrest, which I didn't know they did. Maybe they do the whole hand. But once they'd worked out who it was, they waited for him to attend a meeting to collect his social security benefits, and then they arrested him when he arrived. So he told police that he heard a woman's voice in his head quite a lot of the time, and it would tell him to do things, and that it was this woman's voice that was causing
the murders. I said the kill, kill, kill. It's Lady Macbeth, the bitch.
Nah, she was pretty guilty.
When will she be satisfied? I don't like the lady Macbeth. She didn't kill no one. Don't blame us for persuading people to kill someone.
No, but she felt bad about it as well. She killed herself.
Yeah, right. Leave Lady Macbeth alone.
So she, he, they... So they were worried that he was going to avoid trial because of mental health grounds. So what they did was, which was quite unusual at the time, was they put his photo in the papers to encourage people to come forward with more information so they could tie him to the crimes. Hardly anyone came forward. No one bloody knew him. He had
no friends.
He's creeping
around in the dark as well.
Yeah, no friends. No one really liked him. So very few people came forward. So he was charged with 7 counts of murder and 1 attempted murder. And he pled not guilty. He, Frederick spoke at the trial, so the one he'd attempted to murder and hadn't managed to. He described his attack and how scary it was, and how he'd whispered kill while he was doing it. And there were also workers from the care home in Stockwell, which is where the 2 Polish men were killed. They talked about how they heard someone enter, and they'd grabbed, like, rolling pins and things, like things they could attack him with, and they'd gone to investigate, and they briefly saw him before he fled. So they said that they'd seen him at the scene of the crime, and then one of the workers had said that they'd heard an electric shaver, and they said that they think that he'd killed those 2 men, but then he'd had a shower and shaved and then gone.
Oh,
so they'd sort of found him.
Well, he's living in like a squat, isn't he? So
weird. Oh, it's
probably just taking the opportunity to get clean.
So another witness claimed to have seen Erskine near where Florence was killed on the night that she died, and said that she'd seen him vomiting, and she said that he'd been so weird and creepy, wandering around at night, not really anywhere to go, throwing up in the street, that she'd actually called the police, but by the time the police had come, that he'd already gone. So he was found guilty on all 7 counts of murder, and he was given life imprisonment, where the minimum term was 40 years. But there's 4 more cases that they think were linked to Erskine. So John Jordan...
He's not been convicted for them.
Yeah. John Jordan, 57, he was found strangled in bed in Brixton. Charles Quarrell, 73, he was suffocated in bed in Southwark. Wilfred...
Southwark.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Southwark. Potato, potato. Wilfred Parks, 70, who is strangled in bed in Stockwell. Or is it Stokewell?
No,
sorry.
It's not, sorry.
Only in Southwark.
Trevor Thomas, 75, who was strangled and sexually assaulted, and he was found in his bath at his home in Clapham. So four more people that they closed the cases on because I think they're so convinced that he did it. But
right,
there's just no evidence. There's nothing to pin him to any of those crimes.
It's just a similar pattern.
It just seems to fit with it. So he was originally sent to a normal prison, and then he was transferred to Broadmoor. And while he was at Broadmoor, he actually ended up saving the life of Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper.
No way.
I mean, he's fucking killed all these lovely old people, and then he saves the
another life strangler?
Of the worst other person. So, basically, Peter Sutcliffe was being strangled by inmate Paul Wilson, and Erskine went and got the guards, and it was just in time to save Peter
Sutcliffe. Oh, so he's just being a bit snitchy.
Yeah. It doesn't like seeing other people getting away with strangling. So then, they also reduced his crimes to voluntary manslaughter because of this argument that he had mental health issues and that he couldn't help it. So, and they had gave him a diagnosis of schizophrenia. So he actually went to the appeal and went into court to discuss this idea of that it should be reduced. And he was criticised because he fell asleep in court and he began snoring really loudly.
No.
That's quite funny. So he was like told off by the judge.
No way.
For just falling asleep. And then 2016, he was transferred to a medium secure facility. So the scary thing is that because he did these crimes so young, and his sentences were reduced, that actually he probably could get out. And
but he's in Broadmoor still.
No, he's
back to a normal prison, isn't he?
He's in medium security now.
Because if he was stayed in Broadmoor, it would have been unlikely he'd get out because he wouldn't pass assessments. Yeah.
But obviously he's doing better, so there is a chance that he could potentially get out. Mm. Which if he had a life sentence for each of those murders, he'd have so many years he never would. But they gave him 40 years minimum term.
I see.
But then because they changed the judgment, it might not even be 40 years, it could be less. So I'm hoping
something to think about if you're living in Stockwell.
If you hear someone walking down a corridor towards you, whispering the words, kill, 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 if it's him or not, I'd fucking run.
I was going to say, before hearing this story, that would still shut you up.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for listening.
Turn the page.
Check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/slaughterthepodcast if you would like to hear some extra stuff or vote on the slash and dashes or just contribute and give your hard-earned money to us as
a thank you. Episode Mother-Daughter Slaughters are excellent.
Yep.
Recommend
that. I will get her to do another one soon.
Follow us on Twitter at slaughterthepod.
Yep. Find us on Facebook. So Facebook, guys, I tried a new face mask the other day and it was, I'd honestly look really terrifying. Have you used one of those sheet masks?
Yeah.
In the mirror. So I was thinking, if you've got anything that you do or any weird beauty products that when you use them makes you look absolutely terrifying, put some photos up on Facebook. We'll all have a good giggle. It'll be fun times. And just keep listening, guys. Tell your friends about the podcast and have a lovely bank holiday weekend if you're in the UK. And if you're not, just have a great day.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.